Hello, and welcome to another edition of Bonding Time, BDA's podcast series focused on U.S. fixed income market structure and related issues. I'm Michael Decker, BDA Senior Vice President for Public Policy and Research. Today, we're joined by a team from Oyster Consulting. Oyster is a BDA associate member, and we're grateful for their support of BDA's activities. The three team members joining us today are all directors at Oyster. Today is the first in a series of discussions with the Oyster team, where we'll be looking at key issues surrounding the fixed income markets. Casey Doherty is former Chief Operating Officer, Chief Compliance Officer, and Chief Legal Officer. He spent much of his career at KMS Financial Services in Seattle and came to Oyster from M Holdings Securities. Before Jeff Gearhart joined Oyster, he had a long career at Bank of New York Mellon, culminating as Managing Director in Markets and Securities Finance. Jose Fernandez came to Oyster from BB&T, where he culminated a long tenure as head of FX and director of capital markets operations. Welcome to you all, and thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Michael.
So tell me about Oyster Consulting and your roles there.
Yeah, that was a great introduction, Michael. Oyster Consulting provides support to financial services firms through a network of consulting professionals like the people on the phone here today. I guess we operate in four primary business lines, consulting, outsourcing, compliance, and then our solutions division. The consulting branch works on assisting firms with change management, regulatory events, and process improvement. Our outsourcing branch is typically providing CCOs, FinOps, supervisory compliance professionals when firms need them. Our third group, our compliance group, specializes in periodic testing, our remediation, program review, and support functions. And finally, our solution software is, well, it's a comprehensive and scalable program that we use to manage a number of compliance and exception report functions for firms. So what I think makes Oyster different from other consulting firms is that we're all practitioners. We've done what we preach. Most of us came from decades of working in these areas. And I think actually the average experience of our consultants is, 20 years or more. So I actually work primarily in outsourced CCO and compliance roles. I'm going to let our other guest speakers, Jeff and Jose, tell you a little bit about what they do.
This is Jeff Gearhart. Just jump in real quick there. Oyster's roots are definitely in compliance, but it's grown tremendously over the years. A lot of resources have been added that come, as you said, directly from the industry, former COOs, heads of ops, heads of trading desks. So we've really expanded our resources. And we get involved in all types of engagements around strategic decision-making, future operating models, platform reviews, change management. We've been there, we've done it, we've sat in the seats, so we've experienced the pain and we know how firms have to adapt. And we bring a unique perspective and continue to stay involved in the industry so we can continue to add value in that regard.
Great. Anything to add, Jose?
No, I think my colleagues there pretty much covered the bases, but appreciate it.
Terrific. Today, we're going to focus some time on regulatory and compliance issues. Back in January, FINRA published their exam priorities for 2023, as they do every year. One of the issues on their list is fair pricing for fixed income products and compliance with FINRA Rule 2121 and MSRB Rule G30. What is FINRA trying to accomplish here? What are they looking for in these examinations? And what should firms expect when the examiner visits?
Michael, I'm glad that you referenced the FINRA exam priorities. Reading those along with the SEC's exam priorities is a great way to predict where our regulators are going to focus their attention. I like to recommend to our clients that when those letters come out, that they review their policies and procedures in those particular areas as a strategy to prepare for those regulatory visits. Now, as you pointed out, fair pricing in fixed income products is on FINRA's list, and FINRA notes on its exam priorities that this is a new item this year. Now, new items tend to come out because of trends that FINRA has seen during the last year or few years. Interestingly, FINRA also references in that section Regulatory Notice 2129. I bring that up because that notice was issued in August of 2021. And was a reminder to firms of their obligations to maintain a due diligence and monitoring program related to any outsourced compliance functions. Now, reading those two things together, what that tells me is this has actually been on FINRA's radar for several years, even though they're noting it now as new. Now, I have this right in front of me, so I want to quote one section here that FINRA has. It's the fixed income markup disclosure. And I quote, firms fail to test whether vendors identified the correct prevailing market price from which to calculate markups and markdowns. For example, instead of using the prices of a member firm's own contemporaneous trades, which were available to be considered, a vendor's program incorrectly identified prevailing market prices using lower levels of the quote-unquote waterfall, as described in FINRA Rule 2121. Now, my reading of this is that firms really need to be prepared to defend, and I guess most importantly, defense is documentation, how they're going to be calculating prevailing market price. And I know a lot of us are outsourcing, so if they're outsourcing these calculations, they need to assure that any outsourced vendors are considering the firm's trades, contemporaneous trades, in any calculation. Now, I think Jeff and Jose might have other thoughts on this, so I'd like to get their thoughts here too.
Please.
Sure. So Jeff again, I think when it comes to prevailing market price, firms really need to have to document their process, understand the mechanics of calculating that price, and assign ownership. Ownership is key. You know, as consultants, we often get pulled in when things go wrong. And a lot of times it's because the ownership wasn't clearly defined. When you get into the details of the prevailing market price, you need to understand the models. It's so easy if you do a riskless principal trade or there's a trade in the security recently, but then you have to follow the waterfall correctly in terms of what other markets you check to see what the prices are before you get into the models and the things of that nature. And even with the model, the models that are used for pricing, you can't just blindly rely on that. You have to understand how the model works. For example, how a corporate security is priced, what it's, the spread's being based off of. Make sure they use the right, you know, security curve, pricing metrics, things of that nature. And if they're relying on similar securities, making sure it picks up, you know, all the call features, not just the maturity in the coupon, but everything related to it, even if it's a muni, even geographic preferences. So there's a lot to it. It needs ownership. Someone has to manage it. Jose, your thoughts?
Yeah, thank you for that. I mean, I think just on the heels of what Casey was saying earlier and what Jeff has just mentioned, I think what they're really focusing on is the waterfall. So they've established what this waterfall on, and part of their findings over the course of the last few years has been that firms are not following that waterfall in the intent that it was intended to be used. They're coming up with other methods of obtaining contemporaneous interdealer trades and establishing that as part of their protocol. But also, you know, this has been in place for a number of years, right? So their expectation is that firms are constantly testing their models, updating their grids in the case where they have grids, working obviously with the vendors who are performing the calculations to ensure it complies with the rule itself, but also things such as somebody is using a particular report to monitor this activity. Does that report contain all the relevant information needed, right, for someone to determine whether or not it is in fact calculating the PMP correctly, right? And also disclosing that, as you think about the markup disclosure on confirms, and disclosing that to the client. So there's this particular rule and this requirement has a lot of moving parts to it. And I think at this point, they are looking for firms to really test that process, understand that process, and really not put a process in place and say that they're doing, but actually have some logic behind it, right? As you think about procedures, different products types, different maturities, right? So one of the things, you know, they called out was markups on short-term fixed income securities, which, you know, could significantly reduce the yield received by the investor based off what that markup is, right? So they're looking for granularity across the policies and procedures, the methodology, the logic that's being deployed, and in doing so, ensuring that it is really accomplishing what they intend to do, which is fair market pricing, right, across everything. So some of the effective practices that they've outlined in some of their documentation is the PMP documentation, right? Not just performing a markup, but also when to perform that markup, when do you have to disclose and when do you not need to, right? There's been this, if you look at some of the AWCs over the course of the last 2 years, I mean, there's been some findings over there where firms are over-reporting, right? So they're also taking that into account, right? If you don't need to report it, they expect the process you have in place to exclude those and not report it just because, you know, it's easier to report, right? Mm-hmm. And then obviously the periodic reviews of the markup and markdowns, and really comparing that to any type of industry data that's out there as you think about TRACE and MSRB. You know, FINRA and MSRB both provide analysis reports, right? So they're looking to incorporate all these tools that have been developed in the industry. And then obviously any exception reports provided by the vendor, periodic review, and then and making sure that the report's parameters are performing as intended. So it's a complicated rule. And I think you're starting to see them kind of highlight that in their exam priorities.
Yeah, that all makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yeah. It's no longer just a grid or a threshold percentage. There's more to it now.
Yeah. PMP has been a vexing issue for BDA's members for many years, even before the markup rule was put in place. You know, in the context of complying with just fair pricing, it was a complex and risk fraught concept. So now even more with markup disclosure on the books. Another 2023 exam focus for FINRA is best execution. What should firms be prepared for here?
Yeah, I'll take this one. In looking at best execution, this is not, unlike this last item, the fixed income and PMP, it's not a so-called new item on FINRA's exam priorities for 2023. FINRA's best execution obligations are memorialized in FINRA Rule 5310. And that rule requires, it also has the principle that you need to put your client's interest first. And where you have the ability to direct orders to different markets, you need to have a regular and rigorous process. And I need to emphasize regular and rigorous to assure that your clients receive the most favorable price possible for their transaction, given the market conditions. Now, I know that sounds simple. Hey, it's regular and rigorous. Hey, not a big deal. It's anything but simple in practice. Sometimes it isn't clear in advance what the best markets are. And as we know, significant revenues for firms can be achieved in a compliant way through order routing. So importantly, FINRA does call out fixed income in particular as part of its examination priorities in regard to best execution this year with the following statement. And again, I want to quote, if your firm engages in fixed income and options trading, has it established targeted policies and procedures to address its best execution obligations for these products? Does your firm consider differences among security types within these products, such as the different characteristics and liquidity of U.S. Treasury securities compared to other fixed income securities? And then FINRA also calls attention to the idea of considering and addressing potential conflicts of interest related to routing orders to affiliated broker-dealers, affiliated ATSs, or market centers that provide routing inducements. Such as payment from order flow from wholesale market makers and exchange liquidity rebates. So I think of this in sort of best practices. FINRA doesn't really say, hey, here's the safe harbor. So I really want to ask Jose and Jeff, what have you seen? What are some of these best practices that firms may consider putting in place here?
Jose, you want me to jump in on that one first?
I can jump in. So yeah, I think, you know, as far as best practices is concerned, best X, and I think the one thing to note here is that you're starting to see a lot of those equity terms, right, being utilized as it pertains to best X. The SEC's obviously come out with their version, which is a little bit more, detailed as far as the requirements around it. But at the end of the day, you're starting to see terms like payment for order flow, right? You're starting to hear these equity type terms utilized more and more. So I think what a firm can basically do is kind of start looking at some of the controls or some of the processes or some of the things that they have in place for equity order flow, as well as, you know, how they determine where orders get routed to, the rationale for those decisions, addressing any deficiencies, right, from a standpoint of how would you do it in the equity order, because I think that's where it's leading to. So I think, again, as Casey noted, regular and rigorous reviews, right? You can never review this too many times. But if you think about payment for order flow, you think about the different markets that are out there, right? All the different ATSs, right? Are you actually looking at everything that's out there, and do your policies and procedures outline those different sources of data and provide information as far as the different product types, right? So you evaluate a best execution on treasury security a little bit different than you would a mortgage-backed security, right? So all those things being accounted for. But routing decisions, execution of the quality reviews, different order types, trading conducted really in both regular and extended trading hours, as you think about some of those extended trading hours for certain products, as you think about the international markets, right? And even fractional share, right? These are all things that, again, typically are associated with equities, and you're starting to see them kind of bleed into the fixed income markets. Jeff, anything else you want to add there?
Yeah, I was just thinking from the best practice perspective, BestX isn't new. It's been here for equities and fixed income. But one thing that I know we could have done better when I was actually sitting on some of these committees was gathering metrics around the performance. You have to be using a system nowadays to be generating exception reports and following up on it. You need to make sure the desk owns it, the head of trading owns it. It's not a compliance function. It's not a middle office function. The desk has to own it. But when you're using these systems, one thing to do is just get some metrics around it. You know, which markets are they accessing? Where are you having more flags or more exceptions posting? Is it a trader-specific issue? Is it one of the ECNs you're using? Something of that nature. If you're going to look at best practices and potentially prepare for where the SEC wants to take this, I think that would be a good thing to do. It's been here for a long time. By now, everybody should have the quarterly committee reviews and the systems in place. It's just time to take it to the next level. So there's my two cents.
Jose, you mentioned the SEC's proposed new regulation best execution, a best X rule which would apply in addition to existing best X rules at FINRA and the MSRB. The SEC rule would apply to fixed income products as well as equities. Why does the commission feel current best execution regulation is insufficient? And where do you see this proposal going?
I'm going to start with where this is going. I don't really have a crystal ball on this one. That's really tough to predict. A lot of these rules, proposed rules, they're trying to figure out where they're going to go is anyone's guess. And it depends on which committee at the SEC or FINRA is, I guess, the squeaky wheel. But I think also what I pick up on this is, as you pointed out in your question, both FINRA and MSRB already have best X rules that have been on the books for quite a long time. And it sort of begs the question, what is the SEC looking at here? Why are they all of a sudden deciding, hey, this system doesn't work? And looking at this, if we remember back to early 2021, there were some market breakdowns, not so much related to fixed income, but to meme stocks like GameStop trading. And they highlighted some challenges with market integrity. And that, I think, is the overriding significant concern for our regulators. So fast forward late last year, as a holiday gift, the SEC announced its proposal in December for a new regulation best execution. Now, in the announcement, the SEC concedes that the NASD and now FINRA has indeed had a best execution rule for going on, 55 years now. Now, Chairman Gensler references a few recent developments in the markets, which reveal some of the SEC's thinking, I guess, as to why they think they want a redundant rule to approach it this way. Now, what I noted in the release was the reference to crypto tokens, alternative trading systems, conflicts of interest, and that the rule is actually applicable to broker-dealers, which, again, already presumably are supervised by FINRA. Now, the references to conflicts of interest and prescriptive frequency on how best execution should be done suggests that the SEC shares FINRA's concerns about best execution, as we discussed just a few moments ago, but also implies that the SEC perhaps believes FINRA's efforts in this area, I'm going to say kindly, may have been insufficient to protect the interests of the public. Again, I like to borrow from quotes from this, so I'm just not making things up. But in the release, quote, in the NMS stock market, for example, broker-dealers that primarily service the accounts of individual investors route more than 90% of their customers' marketable orders to a small group of off-exchange dealers known as wholesalers. And the commission believes that customers would benefit from considerations by these retail broker dealers of whether other markets may provide customer orders or a portion of those orders with potentially better execution than wholesalers, end quote. And then the commission believes that customers would benefit from robust considerations by retail broker dealers regarding, for example, the possibility of available liquidity priced at the midpoint of the national best bid and offer at other markets. Now, the article goes on to reference that although data is quite a bit more challenging for fixed income securities, that the prices a client receives are highly correlated to the number of markets a broker-dealer considers in its execution duties. So as such, the SEC believes, I suppose rightly or wrongly, that a more prescriptive approach under the proposed regulation best execution would provide more favorable pricing for clients on fixed income securities. And again, in regard to where this regulation is going, clearly the SEC isn't entirely pleased with the regulations or enforcement in this area. At the least, and I'm not sure if it was Jose or Jeff that mentioned this earlier, you want to give attention to where the regulators are giving attention. So I would give your attention to your best execution strategy, because regardless whether or not it's FINRA under the existing rules or MSRB or SEC under some version of the proposed rule, our regulators are obviously sensitive to this. Now, Jeff and Jose have worked in this area quite a bit longer than me, so I'm interested in their thoughts.
This is Jeff. From my perspective, I find this topic somewhat frustrating, as I'm sure everyone else in the industry does, the SEC jumping into something that's already in place. But maybe I could put a positive spin on it, and that firms already do have a lot of the best X processes and procedures in place. So it's not like you're going to be starting from scratch. It is a little discouraging that they seem to blend equity and fixed income terms, as Jose mentioned earlier. I do find that frustrating. Just the scale of the market, the number of CUSIPs traded in equities versus fixed income is vastly different. Liquidity sources, look at how many fixed income securities are bought and held to maturity, things of that nature. It just they're just different markets, and they're at different degrees of maturity when you look at what percentage is electronic versus equities and fixed income. So that makes having the same standards for best X determination even more difficult. But I do think a lot of the systems in place today can be used there. One thing that concerns me is this definition of conflicted trades. What are you going to have to do when you're dealing with a retail account? And how are you going to document that trade to prove the price was an effective price for the client, things of that nature? That's a concern for me. I don't know that in the fixed income space, the systems are in place yet to deal with that. So it's something that needs to be considered. I would suggest that firms take a healthy look at their current practices. This does fall back into the prevailing market price theory too. Just look at your current practices, understand what you have, and then try to get an idea of what you may have to do if this comes to fruition. We talked to a lot of people and we're finding this is a concern and there's not a clear answer yet. So that's challenging, to say the least.
Yeah, the only thing I'd add is just something that the SEC made comment on, which is basically that the commission also oversees investment advisors, which have a similar duty, right? And I think there's an effort there to try to bring those two together, because I think there's a disparity based off what the expectation of investment advisor is versus what a broker-dealer currently following the FINRA and MSRB rules are. And, the commission has brought a variety of enforcement actions against registered investment advisors, dating back to 2019. So I think that's playing into it as well. But my colleagues' comments, I mean, this is something that, it's an opportunity for you to look at your processes, look at your procedures, look at your documentation, and ensure that to the best you can, you have robust procedures in place and a process in place and have that, again, rigorous and reviews. I mean, this is the theme, right? So just make sure you're doing everything you can to be able to defend your position with this particular rule.
Jeff, you mentioned the treatment of conflicted trades in the proposal. And conflicted trades incorporate principal trades, including riskless principal trades, which really is, if you include principal and riskless principal, that's the vast majority of transactions that take place in the U.S. fixed income markets. That's the issue that's really most difficult from our members' perspective in terms of how they're going to comply if this goes through as drafted. Another issue near the top of BDA's advocacy agenda is trade reporting. Both FINRA and the MSRB have issued companion proposals to reduce the time dealers have to report trades to TRACE and RTRS from 15 minutes to 1 minute. The agencies have argued that a large majority of trades are already reported within 1 minute, and it shouldn't be difficult for dealers to report the rest within 1 minute as well. What kind of challenges would this raise for firms, and where do you see the proposals going?
Now, Michael, I don't want to be flippant here. I tried to imagine sort of a marathon where you have 80% of the runners finishing within a certain time period and saying, oh, of course, we can have 100% finish within that same time frame. I don't think it really works as easily as FINRA is suggesting in this case. Of course, 80% of trades are already reported within a minute. But, you know, I was reading a SIFMA comment letter related to the proposal, and they echoed as much, saying that its members continue to support decreasing the reporting times, but only after a comprehensive study by the SROs. They also indicated that they'd like adoption to be in steps. I think it's unreasonable, of course, for a regulator to come in and say, all right, yeah, we're going to go from 15 minutes down to one. Let's try 15 minutes down to 14 or 13 and do it in step fashion. And I think that's ultimately where we're going to end up here. I think the other challenge, of course, here is that I haven't seen any real research that actually defends that the public or investors would indeed benefit in any sort of meaningful way from those last 20% of trades being reported more quickly. But again, I want to turn over the floor here to Jeff and Jose for some thoughts on this.
Yeah, this is one where, you know, obviously there's been a lot of comments with relation to this proposal. And really what it comes down to is, you know, understanding how those transactions are affected today, right? There's still a good amount of the industry that still does transactions kind of the old fashioned way, right? Pick up the phone, talk to somebody, even if they're using, you know, electronic communications such as chat and things of that nature to execute. But there's still this manual process that creates some challenges with, you know, reporting something in a timely manner. 1 minute is something that is going to be hard to achieve without every firm investing in the technology, right? Which is another thing that was raised by many members, which is, you know, the cost, right? So for you to have straight through processing from front to back office, there's a cost associated with that. And a lot of them have commented that, you know, that cost is something they can't bear, right? So, you know, are you putting some dealers in a position whereby, you know, they have to decide whether they're going to remain in the business or not based off this requirement? So there are a lot of things that occur. You know, you've had some Service Bureau comment about security master issues and the timeliness it takes to resolve some of those things. You know, that's going to affect the ability to report. You talk about some of the exceptions that are out there currently today, as you think about Lister fixed offering price and some of the other ones that are out there. But I think one of the biggest ones out there is this whole sub-account allocations under your accelerated reporting requirement. And that is that the process is one where it doesn't afford them the ability to electronically solve for that. So being able to report a transaction, a box size trade at a certain price, and then be able to sub-allocation associated with will go into an affiliated dealer, which have to have certain codes associated with that, as well as, you know, those that are, for example, managed accounts that have to have a separate type of a code, right? Those where you're not charging the fee, those that have commissions versus fees, all these things. Hey, the rules allow for you to report those transactions, give you certain codes that you need to provide with each of those transactions in your reporting. But that 15 minutes gives you that the ability to do that. When you compress that down to 1 minute, I think some of the concerns there is just even the technology exists today, it's going to be difficult to do that. So, you know, this is one of those that is going to get a lot of attention for obvious reasons. And this may be one that, you know, I think if it goes through as proposed, what you're end up seeing basically is, you know, a lot of firms are just going to start processing things just to process it, right? And then have to deal with it after the fact. So in other words, you know, just to report it, let me report it. And I have to cancel rebill there, I'll cancel rebill there, but you're gonna start seeing an increase in cancel rebills potentially, right? Just because of that increased pressure to comply. And so these are the unintended consequences, right? And are you really seeing what you're hoping to achieve by reducing that reporting time? So there's a lot of energy around this, obviously, for various reasons, but as far as, you know, where the proposal is going, I think it's going to be one of those, you know, as we think about 4210, right, where it's to be out there, it's going to be amended, it's going to go out there for proposals again or comments again, and going to go back and forth until you land in some place that, you know, is acceptable by all parties, whether that's that 15 minutes with some additional details or additional exceptions or additional reporting requirements, or gets reduced to, you know, 5 minutes, for example, you know, it's anyone's guess. But what we do know at this point is that the investment in technology infrastructure for a lot of these dealers is going to be tough for them to stomach, and changing habits, which is even harder, right? As you think about a lot of the transactions that are done over the phone right? Because they want to hand, and those, you know, and the analysis, as Casey mentioned, is, you know, they're looking for further analysis by the SROs, right? Are they analyzing the size of the transactions, right? It's been my experience that, you know, block size trades of 5 million, 10 million, 20 million, those aren't typically done on these ATSs, right? Those are, you know, you've got to put through that certain sizes, a million and under. But, you know, the block size trades, you still want to pick up the phone. You still want to negotiate with someone, right? So capturing that, is, again, within that one time frame is going to be a challenge. But, yeah, a lot of energy, and I expect a lot more to come with regards to this before it actually gets adopted, if it gets adopted.
Absolutely. Definitely. 1 minute leaves no margin for error. The final issue we'll talk about today, the SEC has taken up in their muni enforcement program the limited offering exemption to SEC Rule 15C212. Under this provision, dealers are exempted from having to obtain and distribute an OS for a new muni issue if the deal is sold only to sophisticated investors, the number of customers buying the deal is 35 or fewer, and the dealer has a reasonable basis to believe that the customers don't intend to resell their securities. It's that last requirement that the SEC is focused on. The SEC has suggested they believe more cases around this are coming. What should firms know about this, and what should they be doing?
Yeah, there's that word. I see it a lot, this reasonable or reasonableness. That is, that's extremely tough. You know, as you pointed out, Michael, in September of 2022, the SEC took enforcement actions against four muni security underwriting firms for failing to comply with Rule 15C212 disclosure requirements. Now, the firms believe that they were exempt from such requirements under the, quote, limited offering exception. Yet, as you referenced, they allegedly failed to satisfy the reasonable belief requirements that are necessary for the disclosure exemption. Now, there's even a more recent case from March of this year that cites the firm's alleged failure to adopt policies and procedures reasonably designed to screen for whether the exemption can be relied upon, and then a system to form a reasonable belief that the purchasers are using the securities for investment purposes. Now, in the March case, the SEC found that the firm did not inquire or otherwise determine if the broker-dealers and investment advisors were purchasing the securities for more than one account or for distribution. They also found that it failed to ascertain for whom the broker-dealers and investment advisors were purchasing the securities. So from that, the SEC concluded that the firm was unable to form a reasonable belief that the broker-dealers and investment advisors were purchasing the securities for investors who possess the necessary knowledge and experience to evaluate the investments. Now, in looking at all this, really in crafting procedures for the exemption, the takeaway here for me is that firms need to have policies and procedures that require some level of inquiry. And really, the rule, name of the game now is documentation. So it's not just inquiry, it's inquiry and documentation of it, policies and procedures around it, if they're going to be relying on the exemption. At the least, I would consider obtaining an attestation from the broker-dealers or RIAs distributing the securities that they don't have any reason to believe the securities are for resale. Of course, there should also be some inquiry about who the specific customers are, even if that list is redacted in some way to protect privacy. And then the accounts for those securities and the assertion by the broker-dealer RIA that the purchasers have some base level of sophistication. Again, Jeff and Jose, I'm open to other thoughts on this too.
Yeah. You know, from my perspective, I don't think this issue is going to go away. There's a whole lot of focus on transparency of issuers' financials and things of that nature. And it has been, it's only increasing. And I recall on our muni desk, with the salespeople, with the traders, with the public finance team, as the rules keep coming out, you know, there's difficulty in adapting. And then sometimes there's sluggishness or just an assumption that maybe it doesn't apply to us. I think in this case, it's not going to go away. So following your lead, Casey, you know, adding more documentation, evidencing how you're in compliance. It didn't used to be that way, but it is now. So I think you need to make sure everything's documented, policies and procedures accurately reflect what you're going to do and show ownership. I think, you know, a checklist on a new issue is very common practice, but make sure this is in there. And then perhaps the one point I would stress here is education. You just got to keep bringing it up with the sales team, with the trading teams, and with the public finance team. This is what's required. This is what happens when you don't do it. And make that part of the performance reviews. And you know, if you do get dinged with a fine, then that goes against the desk or the public finance team's performance. Not trying to be heavy-handed there, but that's how you have to address something like this that's just not going to go away. That's my perspective.
Maybe the most frustrating aspect of this is the fact that the rule doesn't mention documentation, doesn't mention record keeping around the reasonable basis provision of the rule. Yet the SEC, when they examine for this, expects to see some kind of documentation, memorialization of a phone call or something that would demonstrate the reasonable basis to believe.
Yeah. Michael, I just wanted to jump in. I agree with you on that. And it's very frustrating having sat in those seats, but it's, what is it, regulation by enforcement? We can't make that argument anymore that it wasn't in the policy. It's evidencing has just become key to protecting yourself.
Casey, Jeff, and Jose, this has been a great discussion. A lot of new and interesting perspectives and information. Thank you all so much for joining us today. Thank you for Oyster's continued support of BDA and our mission and activities. And stay tuned for the next conversation with the Oyster team coming up soon.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Michael. It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Michael.